everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's October 2024, and you're listening to episode 413, which discusses a Christian's response when a pastor is removed from his church over moral failure. Today's guest is Anne Kennedy. She has an MDiv and is the author of Nailed It, 365 Readings for Angry or Worn Out People, and blogs about current events and theological trends on her Substack, Demotivations with Anne. Anne has written an article for her column in the Christian Research Journal, which is called Theological Trends. The title of her article is A Christian's Response to Pastor Lawson's Moral Failure, and you can read it for free at our website, equip.org. That's equip.org. Anne, it's good to have you on the podcast again.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, today we are talking about the latest installment of Anne's regular column, which is kind of looking at the church and different theological trends is what we call it. And I don't know that this is a trend. I hope it's not a trend, but really people are thinking and have come to the Christian Research Institute asking when they hear about another moral failure of a pastor, a well-known pastor. And I'm sure we could put in a whole bunch of different names, but we are going to today speak about Pastor Steve Lawson, because he's just one of the latest, you know, over the years, many names that we could put into that category. And not just pastors. Anne and I have talked about well-known women who are Bible teachers that we have covered in the past, and they have also fallen into this category too. They've had some issues and gotten divorced and things like that. But that's a big question that people have. Just how do they think about, process biblically, someone that they looked up to, someone who influenced their own theological and spiritual journey, someone whose books they read, where they went to conferences that they spoke at, and suddenly this person has a very big fall. So since I mentioned that we are specifically talking about Steve Lawson, who's the person of the fill in the blank day to time now, who is Steve Lawson and why are we talking about moral failure of pastors?
Well, yes, the latest, it is sort of becoming habit that this just sort of comes up at regular intervals. In fact, I was just looking at an article, and at the end of the article about Steve Lawson, there's a list of like six maybe or seven other pastors who I had never heard of who have been similarly just removed very quickly from ministry. They probably are well known. It's just that I hadn't heard of them. So it does seem to be a thing that is happening. I think it's always happened, but we are very much aware of it, especially with social media. So Pastor Steve Lawson was through this last Sunday, I don't even know how many days it's been since the weekend, but on the 15th, he preached a sermon in his church of Trinity Bible Church in Dallas. And then during the week, he was removed from ministry and his name was taken off the website. And the church says that they're not paying him anymore. He was there for, he was married. He is still married, as far as I can tell, has been married for about 40 years. And he was at Trinity Bible Church for a really long time. And he had something called One Passion Ministries. But I think people really know him because he was often on the stage with John MacArthur. And he was associated with Ligonier Ministries. And he, you know, when kind of big conferences come up, he was one of those people who was often on the stage, who would give a sermon. And he was a dean, one of the deans at the Master's Seminary. So he's pretty well known for those who kind of know about conservative evangelical, you know, that world in America anyway. And so it's kind of filtered out on Twitter, which is not a great way to have this kind of thing like sift out slowly that he was, well, at first it was called an inappropriate relationship, but that he was unfaithful to his wife with a woman who was much, much younger than him. And there are not a lot of other details except that people are saying that his family is devastated and the church is devastated. Although the church did not really address it on Sunday in the sermon. So I don't know how far we are out from the original, you know, announcement. Time sort of gets lost on Twitter, I found. But they did not really address it on Sunday. So I think that that's probably not to their benefit or anybody else's. So I'm really hoping that they will come out and say a little bit more. Hopefully nothing salacious or anything like that. But there should be some kind of explanation about what happened, what he did, and why.
So when you search for things and read articles, they characterize this situation as his moral failure. Why would you say that the phrase moral failure is not the best characterization about what happened in his particular case, why he was removed?
Well, I feel like Christians like to use words like struggle, for example. And often, you know, a Christian will say, well, I struggle with, you know, lust, or I struggle with envy. And it's this sort of catch-all term to say that you might have a besetting sin and you're trying to work on it, but that maybe you're not doing a good job and maybe you are failing. I feel like the term moral failure kind of falls into that realm. It's sort of passive. It's like, I just didn't succeed. You know, I tried really hard and I just didn't make the grade. I failed instead of succeeding. Whereas I think committing a sin is a little more active than that. I mean, there are two kinds of sin. There's the sins of omission and the sins of commission. So you can commit a sin or you can just fail to do what's right. And this really is like, it's this, you know, the commission sin where you actively do something wrong. And so I think for most of us, the word moral sort of, it has kind of a wide leeway on it. It's a word that catches many different things. You can be morally good. You can be morally bad. I mean, but that can be defined by the culture. But to pursue a sexual relationship with someone you're not married to, especially if you're a pastor, a well-known pastor, or any pastor of a church, you didn't just sort of not meet the mark. You went out and did something you knew you ought not to do. And you probably spent some time sorting out how you were going to do it. So there's some thought that goes into it. And so it's much more active than the term moral failing. I feel like that's just not a very sharp, good way of describing this. I think to say that it's a sin is a very good thing, but even to say that it's a grave sin and it's a sin against the body of Christ as well against Jesus makes it even more poignant and terrible.
It's interesting because it's characterized, so the Bible characterizes these things as adultery. And adultery, as the Bible speaks of it, is really a sin against, well, obviously also it's a sexual sins, the Apostle Paul talks about, are even more serious because they're a sin against the body. Now, we don't know. It just says inappropriate relationship with a woman. And so sometimes it's not named, but isn't that adultery? And the sin of adultery is addressed many times. Sometimes it is involved in actual marriage, but it's also the way the Bible characterizes it is it's a direct sin against God, the nature of God, who he is, etc. So it's kind of interesting that most of the articles are just using the phrase in the headlines, he's had a moral failure, and then in quotes, it'll say an inappropriate relationship with another woman.
Yeah, the term inappropriate relationship is a very mild euphemism, honestly. And it's a bad one because it could mean anything. It could just mean that you made somebody feel uncomfortable, or you were having coffee with somebody you shouldn't, you know, and you started to get emotionally attached to them, maybe it's, I think, better to say when somebody, you know, the sin that somebody commits, if you commit adultery, that should be known, because it's a spiritual issue. It's not just a sin of two people against each other. It's the sins, it implicates the whole, in the case of David, it implicates the whole nation of Israel. And right, God uses it as a metaphor for our rejection of him, our idolatry, our running after other gods. So I did not love the term inappropriate relationship being thrown around. Like, that sort of was a decent way of talking about what's happened.
To be that, I mean, he came forward according to news reports, but to be so summarily dismissed, no longer paid, removed from websites where he was in leadership at various, like, different seminaries or parachurch ministries, including the one he founded. It seems, and we don't know the details, that it was the phrase inappropriate relationship might not characterize the true nature of what happened because of the severity, I guess, of how serious it must have been to have all of that scrubbed from all of your outreaches and ministry influence.
Yeah, it's like, obviously it's way more than just inappropriate. It must have been unbelievably damaging for his family and for his congregation for them to swoop in so quickly. I mean, I don't know if people have had a chance to go in and watch his sermon from September 15th, but it's a little bit haunting because it seems like he knows what's coming down the pike. So maybe he had admitted something by then, although it doesn't seem like it, but he is sort of fighting for his legacy almost in that sermon. And he characterizes, he says you should not write off somebody because of a hiccup. And so the, you know, inappropriate relationship and hiccup, some people were saying on Twitter, have become the new euphemisms for adultery. And those, you know, that's a little bit funny, but also really, really terrible.
Here's what we've got coming up on future episodes of the Postmodern Realities podcast that you will not want to miss out on. We are going to cover the phenomenon at Skinwalker Ranch that has been on the History Channel. We are reviewing season 2 of Amazon Prime's series Rings of Power, based on J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, specifically his universe in the Silmarillion. And we are going to cover the issue as it relates to voting, which is coming up in the United States. And we are going to cover an issue and call it Voting to Limit Evil. Now, that's different than voting for the lesser evil. So why is that different? And why should a Christian consider voting to limit evil? So those are some of the things that are coming up. And we are going to be covering also the theology of James Cone. We are going to cover a theology of work later in this year. So there's a lot of really wonderful things coming up on the Christian Research Journal's Postmodern Realities podcast. You don't want to miss it. And we hope that you will let other people know about some of the things we're going to be covering in the future by just telling a friend about this podcast and rating and reviewing it, specifically on Apple Podcasts. And so thank you for your partnership with us just by getting the word out about the podcast. And you can find all of the articles that we talk about every week, a brand new article, no paywall, no subscription, at our website, equip.org. Now back to my conversation with Ann Kennedy and what a Christian's response is or should be regarding the moral failure and very public sins of a pastor. So we were just talking about the circumstances in this case, and we, like we said, we could put in various different names that have come up over the years that have had this similar situation where they were removed due to a relationship with a woman, not their wife. But it is interesting because, I mean, You know, he's had a very long ministry because he's in his 70s or at least 70. And so there's a lot of stuff on social media, including videos that he made about how to conquer lust and live a holy life. And so because of that, there have been a lot of you were speaking earlier about social media. So in, you know, 2024, when something salacious, I guess, happens as far as the culture is concerned, there's a lot of, I think, even with non-Christian people, Schadenfreude out there, but there is a big outcry from various different points of view on social media as to what needs to be done. So what are the different kinds of responses that are being bandied about on social media regarding this, especially if people are looking up some of his older sermons? Even you said it seemed like it was almost prophetic, or he knew something was happening with his most recent sermon before he was removed.
Right. There's now always two stories. There's both the, you know, the thing that happens, and then there's the Twitter, you know, unraveling and how people talk about it always seems to become part of the story. And I suppose those of us who write about what's going on kind of contribute to that, because it's hard not to just comment on the commentary. And I thought this was interesting this time because there were a good number of people who came out and tried to say that Reformed theology has been utterly discredited because Pastor Lawson was a Calvinist and he taught about the sovereignty of God. And so that must mean that he probably thinks that it's God's fault that he did this bad thing. And I thought that was interesting because that just shows that a lot of people out there who react against Calvinism don't know anything about Calvinism. And I mean, if you think that something like this undermines the doctrine of the sovereignty of God, then you really haven't investigated your theology very well. So I enjoyed that one. The other sort of interesting thing I thought was that there was a lot of people who were really, really grieved, of course, because he's had a long public ministry. And so a lot of people have really benefited from his preaching, which to this point, as far as I know, has been completely faithful within the pale of orthodoxy. And so those people were sad. And so then a group of, you know, people who felt like it was better to be angry than sad kind of emerged, and they went at it back and forth. And then there was just, I don't know, there was a good, a number of good comments, but you know, like the person who noticed that inappropriate relationship has become a new euphemism for adultery. That was actually a helpful comment, I thought. And then I also saw, this was really, I think, tasteless. Tullian Chivijian, I don't know how to say his last name, who was one of the very first people in the age of social media to really blow up his ministry in this way, got out and was prepared to give advice to Steve Lawson about, you know, how God is so gracious. So a number of people came back at him, and I thought rightly, to say, hey, you know, maybe sit this one out just for a few minutes. You've rehabilitated yourself. That doesn't really give you a good platform to tell people who are in the middle of, as you said, a serious moral failing, that it's all going to be okay. So it was interesting to watch it kind of spin. It fell basically along predictable lines, but I did feel like, in some sense, I think arguing about scandals like this is kind of almost a self-protective way of not having to really deal with the fact that the church has been, you know, a little bit humiliated by a well-known pastor being willing to sin in a way that he himself has preached against. I think the term for that is hypocrisy, and that's always a hard pill to swallow for, you know, the ordinary faithful who, you know, are always castigated for being Christian at all. It really doesn't make things good for them.
I do think that is a question for, you know, as an apologetics ministry at the Christian Research Institute, you know, the Christian apologist feels like people are saying, well, you see, Christianity really isn't true. This is just like, add this scandal. You are just like everybody else. This, you know, It doesn't make any difference. Christianity makes no difference in lives because people are pursuing this, and behind their back, they're against the teaching that they are saying that prohibits their very actions that they are doing. And so I think also, you know, as we were mentioning, that he's just another name that now, because we have social media and we have the internet, we just see there's a long list of names of pastors and others who have well-known Christian leaders or influencers who have damaged their own ministry based on you know, what they've done, their personal actions that are against the very teachings of the Bible. And so I guess the question is, some people want to know, is it something modern? Is it because we're, our modern view of sexuality, you were just talking about polyamory earlier, our views are so more open to all kinds of things. So are pastors sinning more than they used to? Although I don't know if we can think that if we read the Bible, right? But is there a higher rate of sin suddenly that we're more aware of in terms of the history of the church?
I mean, I've kind of been asking myself that all week because it does seem super discouraging. I was just like, I was immediately thinking of Ravi Zacharias, and I was suddenly really grateful that, you know, my grandmother and my great aunt, who loved his ministry and supported him, died before all of that came out. And then I thought, well, that's kind of silly that I would, you know, why would I worry about that? God's grace is sufficient, you know, and it is, of course, but it's also just notoriously terrible when somebody so famous dies. So, I mean, I think on the surface, or the easy answer is, of course, things have always been really bad. And if you read about the kings of Israel, you can see that the propensity of the human heart is to commit really grievous and terrible sin, and to do it generationally and systemically, and to keep doing it no matter who comes to warn you not to do it. That's why we needed a savior. At the same time, I do think it's totally acceptable to consider the cultural circumstances in which you find yourself. And one of ours is that we do live in a world that is so decadent. It's awash in sexual idolatry and ruin, and all under the guise of personal authenticity. You know, I just recently, there have been tapes of a prominent doctor in New York City who was setting COVID policy, and he just was engaged in orgies during the COVID lockdown. And he said, as part, he was caught in a sort of undercover, you know, one of those taping situations. And he said, I just love being my authentic self. And he kind of threw it away like this easy line, you know, like, of course, having sex in an orgy with a lot of strangers is part of my personal authenticity. And I don't think that it's easy for, you know, the social guardrails that we've had in the West were good. The call to self-discipline, to self-denial, to sexual chastity, those were a help to many, many people who, you know, the, any warning that you get against sin is all to the good. And so I think as those fade away and there's no real social stigma, the only stigma comes within the Christian community itself. And I mean, I hope that that comes to bear for Pastor Lawson. I hope he feels the deep weight of this so that he can eventually feel the mercy and grace of Christ and to know that he is forgiven and the cross is for him. But I don't think it's easy for pastors today because you're going totally upstream from the culture, and your congregation may not even, if you're a church that's not well connected to other churches, your congregants may not even know that adultery is that bad, you know, or they may be confused about issues of sex themselves. And so I grieve for the state of the church because the state of the world is so broken, sexually broken in particular.
I think the idea, speaking back to the phrase moral failure, but I think the idea, the classical idea of virtue, is not even something that
our culture cares about or wants to pursue at this point, when it is so much, everything that bombards us is so much, virtue doesn't matter. It's about finding your own self and however, you know, Anna's covered some of these things, whether it's been the view of manifesting or positive affirmations. There's so much that's bombarding us. And it is true in the past, even if in Bible times, that they lived in a very decadent, sexually permissive time. But it seems to me there's so much more immediacy here. They did not have the kind of technology that we had where it is so immediate. You had to go seek it out very specifically. And now it's like, you know, everybody has a computer in their pocket and it's right there. So it is a little, you know, I don't know that people are sinning more than they have been sinning, but I think the temptations come to us in such an immediate fashion that might not have been true, like, you know, 1500 years ago.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you're totally right there. I just don't know very many American men who aren't dealing with issues of lust related to technology, as you've said. And I know a lot of pastors have dealt with that. And it's not a gray area, but it is like it's so pervasive. I don't think any living person can totally get away from the world and from the sexual immorality of the world. And so I can see why it might be really easy if you're in a really bad place and you don't have a good marriage to begin to justify behaviors and actions that are totally unjustifiable and to get, you know, caught in some devastating sin. But all the more reason to have structures in place for yourself if you're a pastor so that that just does not happen.
So that's a question that I have really is, you know, we find these things, and even you were saying you just thought about it this week. It's just so sad. I've thought about it. And then speaking of that doctor that you were talking about, if you follow the news in any fashion, you can't have escaped the arrest of Sean P. Diddy, Puff Daddy Combs, who was also using his businesses and different things to, you know, conduct these really just heinous sexual abusive folks. And so it's just kind of all around, and it's mind boggling. You're like, who would even do that? Why would they do that? Why would they even think that this is okay? And so I think Christians have been kind of bombarded both by somebody who's not claiming to be a Christian and, you know, under federal indictments, and a well-known media person, and then this pastor. So Christians are wondering, well, what is the biblical response to all this? It's just so sad and, you know, just makes you feel like horrible and also really just mortified and all different kinds of feelings that you have when you've heard about these things. So what is the biblical response to the sin of some famous pastor like Pastor Lawson, or even a person like Sean Combs, who maybe people listen to his music. I don't know. He has explicit music, but, you know, he was lauded as somebody who's helping bring up, you know, minorities and all this kind of stuff. And then now all this stuff is revealed. So how should someone try to deal with that biblically and get their mind around, like you said, even when you're describing that doctor, just the real heinous, grievous sexual sins?
I was just listening to Al Mohler. I think he gave a speech or a talk in his chapel, maybe this morning. I didn't quite see the date on it. And I was really comforted because he said, the first thing is that it's totally okay to feel really deep grief and to feel sad. And then he said, it's also acceptable to be outraged. It's good, in fact, I would say, to not indulge in anger, but the initial feeling of anger when you discover that somebody that you trusted or that was in a position of trust violated that trust, you have been given that instinctual feeling by God, and you shouldn't dull it, you know, by trying to talk yourself out of it. If somebody is in a position of trust and they violate that trust and you feel angry about it, that means you're basically at least a little bit functioning in at least one area of your life. But I would say, of course, that you can't stay there. I cling all the time just to the simple line from the Psalms to leave rage alone. So, I mean, rage comes to you for all kinds of good reasons. And then I do think it's the Christian's duty to put it down at a certain moment and walk away from it, because we are sinners. And the problem is that the sin comes to us from within ourselves. It's not as though Pastor Lawson had to go looking for this kind of sin in some foreign place. This was in his heart already. Just like every sin comes from the heart. Jesus says that to us. We don't need to worry about what we put in our mouths, because sin comes out of our mouths. It's in our nature. It's who we are. And so our anger can only endure for just a little bit before it needs to turn into, I think, into both pity and prayer and a desire for personal holiness, into humility, into a quick sense that, you know, there's no person who escapes the fact of eventually having really ugly things inside them that appear for other people to see. And that is humiliating in a good way, because if you can see that you were so deeply wrong that it hurt other people, it will be easier for you to forgive other people when they do ugly things, when they sin. So, but this is contrary to the way that we're taught to view ourselves. We're given so much encouragement to think of ourselves as good, and so, and other people as bad or a failure or just sub-immoral, maybe. That's not how we ought to think. We should think of ourselves as sinners, and we should learn to accept the forgiveness of Christ in our own lives so that we can then extend it to other people when it's appropriate to extend it to them, and not hang on to bitterness. Like, I'm going to have to forgive this doctor in my own state, even though he doesn't know who I am, for what he did to my state and to many people who were vulnerable in that time. It's not okay for me to hang on to that. That would be wicked of me, actually. And so the same goes for anybody who does anything. You have to be prepared to forgive ultimately because of the cross. And that's what makes Christians different from other people, is that they know they're not invited to revenge or bitterness or grudges, but that the mercy of the cross is the thing that defines and characterizes us as the people of God.
What about the person, maybe they're not feeling anger, but they read about it and they're shocked and they just think to themselves like, well, I'm not as bad as Pastor Lawson. I would never do such a thing. I mean, how do you respond to that? Because I think in some folks' minds, I mean, there could be some, as I said, the schadenfreude of people with the glee. Oh, here's this person who said they were Calvinists and look what's happened to them. But I think sometimes, especially like you're talking about that doctor in your state, you know, people will read that and, or read about P. Diddy and be like, oh, well, I'm not like that. And I would never do that. I'm not that bad of a person. I mean, some Christians can think of that. How should they think rightly, biblically, when they are going down that path? Maybe it's not an anger path. Maybe it's just more, I'm so much of a better person.
I do recoil when people say to me, I'm just not that kind of person, because you should never say that. You might be that kind of person. You don't know. If you don't have, you know, by the grace of God, you don't have the money, the power, the influence of P. Diddy. And that's to your benefit. If you were in a position of wealth and comfort and self-indulgence, you don't know the kind of sins you would commit. Your narrow, constrained, frustrating life was given to you by God to spare the world from the terrible sins that you would commit. That's what I say to myself. And I have said it to people when they've said to me, oh, I'm just not that kind of person. I question them as kindly as I can, because we are the kind of people who sin. And the thing about temptation is that it comes to us from the outside, but it always corresponds often very neatly to the things inside us that are already wicked. So you may not, you know, be inclined towards orgies and sexual deviance, but you may be really tempted to slander someone or to steal or to be bitter and angry. And while not all sins are the same, all sins are vile and all sins separate us from the love of God unless we repent. So, you know, it's good to keep short accounts and to confess your own sins a lot so that you don't become habituated to them and try to justify them that they're okay. And I think the people who say, I'm just not that kind of person, I would never do that, often have something in their life that everybody else can see, but they haven't noticed it and they don't know that it's ugly.
So those are kind of helpful to think through different responses that we might have and how should we biblically start thinking about how we think of these things when we hear about them. But also I think the one response is the, you know, just the person in the pew. I mean, not all Christians are called to visible types of leadership in ministry. And there's just a lot of folks just in the pew, just the faithful part of the body that is just coming to the church every week. And so, you know, they might be concerned about their own pastor, whether it's a pastor of a, you know, small church plant of 50 people or a growing church of hundreds or even a church of thousands, maybe not to the numbers of Pastor Lawson, but how can we best support our pastors knowing that the Bible says that we're in a spiritual battle and definitely the devil would like to see the church destroyed and people brought down. It helps him to try to sow division among the church or do any number of things. So the person that's concerned about their own pastor, how should they best support him?
I mean, this is so crucial. I think one of the things, it seems like very small and inconsequential, but of course the thing that the faithful need to do for their pastors is pray for them and really pray, not just sort of, you know, when they remember, they should write it down on a piece of paper and every day they should pray for their pastor, because the problem is that the pastor, his job is really impossible. He can't change the world. He doesn't do anything seen. All of his work is against the wisdom of the world. He has to preach, but he has no control over what happens in people's hearts when he preaches. He has to visit the sick, but he can't keep people from dying. He counsels people in their broken relationships and marriages, but, you know, very often people don't listen to him, and then he can't force people to reconcile if they won't. All the things that he does are beyond his control. So he works day and night, but he doesn't get to know and he can't affect the change in people that he longs for. And so I think one of the biggest besetting sins of pastors, especially in the modern era, is probably self-pity on one hand, and often probably despair and discouragement. And I mean, I don't know, it's hard for me to even understand what would go on for Pastor Lawson, because he had, from all appearances, a super successful and big church and the kind of ministry that many, many people long to have and think that if they had it would make them happy. And so I don't know what he was dealing with, but I do know that ordinary pastors who are obscure, who don't get the acclaim, are worn out. And in those kinds of situations, it's easy to justify small sins that turn into big ones. And so I think pastors need encouragement from their congregations. They need to know that their preaching is making a difference in the lives of the people. They need to know that they're being prayed for. People should ask them how they're doing and then really listen to the answer, which is hard because, you know, most of us, when we ask somebody how they're doing, we don't really want to know. It could be embarrassing. It could bring something to light that you don't know how to cope with. But I think there should be people in congregations who ask that question, and the pastor knows that it's a real question and that a real answer is required. And that if he's not doing okay, he should say it out loud that he needs help or that he's discouraged and he feels like giving up. I think, you know, many men, it's always good for a pastor to have friends with other pastors, but that's not always possible. And so I do think that the marriage of the pastor should be the concern of the congregation. If he's having marriage trouble, the congregation, the elder board, the if he has a bishop or, you know, some kind of structure that comes around him for accountability, he should be invited in a, you know, a gracious way to be able to work on his marriage if he has a bad marriage. If he needs a sabbatical because his marriage is bad, he should be given a sabbatical, and that shouldn't be, you know, he shouldn't feel guilty about that, because his spiritual well-being and the well-being of his family is directly bound up with the congregation. And so if that goes south because people are don't want to hear about it, or they're, you know, they're not interested, that's going to redound to everybody's shame. We all partake of each other's ruin ultimately when we sin. And so I just think, you know, he should get his full amount of vacation time every year. He should be able to unplug from the parish. There's just a lot of little things like that that congregations and elder boards can take care of their pastors so that they can stay on track and not fall into sin from weariness and from discouragement. Of course, there are always going to be people who fall, and that's not the fault of the congregation when that happens. But I do think that there's a lot that can be done to care for ministers that could really benefit them and maybe keep some of these from happening.
Now, you've addressed the person who says, well, I'm shocked and I'm glad I'm not, you know, I'd never do something like that. But what about the people who are grieved, but also very concerned? Like, how, as a Christian, should I be walking with Christ and involved in my local church so that I do not start going down a path where, you know, I would be tempted to engage in this kind of inappropriate, quote unquote, inappropriate relationship with someone not your spouse? And some of those things could even be to single people. I mean, it doesn't have to be a spouse. How would that person say, okay, how do I walk worthily before the Lord? Because this is concerning. I mean, I don't want to do those kinds of things, as opposed to, I'm glad I'm not like that person because I'd never do that.
Right. I mean, I think that's a really good question. I think we should fear for our own salvation with, you know, we should work out our salvation with fear and trembling, which I think it indicates a certain kind of humility, even humble anxiety for the sake of one's soul. And the first thing to do, of course, is to go to church. And when you're there, let people know who you are. Sin loves the darkness and loves secrets and lies. And so the more you can tell the truth to other people and to yourself in a community of people, the less purchase there will be for sin and for the devil and for the flesh and for the world to take a hold of you. And that's really hard. It's very hard to be vulnerable and open with people who you may not know very well, you know, to join a home group or to start attending a Bible study and to actually talk to the people who are there and let them know who you are and what your struggles are and, you know, your real struggles, not your fake ones that you've given up on, or the cute ones, you know, that are not really sins, like you just love people too much or that kind of thing. No, what are you really like, and how have you really sinned, and what are your temptations? Those kinds of things come up when we live together, when we take communion together and we listen to the same sermon and we pray for each other. You have to embed yourself in a community of people who gradually come to care for you. And I do think it really does work. I mean, I think one reason why this is so shocking is because it isn't really an everyday occurrence that the pastor runs off and commits adultery. I think most pastors are faithful and they care for their flock and they pray for the sheep and they are anxious for them. And if you put yourself under the care of somebody like that, you have the benefit of that person's ministry over your soul, and God uses that as a grace in your life. So it's not, you know, there's no like foolproof thing that you can do, but just the ordinary work of being in a church and knowing the people there and opening yourself to the grace of Christ is the best way to battle sin.
And I also think something that you just mentioned a few moments ago is you said sometimes, you know, especially the people who are saying, I'm glad I'm not like that person, and other people around them can see things they're not aware of, is I think all of us have to have a humility before the Lord. And like, you know, John the Baptist said that we need to decrease and Christ needs to increase. And we need to pray that the Lord would reveal to us our sins that we're not aware of and to want to know what those are. I think a lot of people, again, and we can actually in our own sin think, I'm not as bad as X, and, you know, I'm not as bad as P. Diddy or Dr. New York or Steve Lawson or whatever it is. And I think that we need to have the, as we're involved in the life of the church, as we read the word, as we're under the preaching and sacraments, and also for our own personal prayers in our own life, that we want the Spirit to change us. We want to know what sins that we have that we might not be aware of, which is the exact opposite of what the world is telling us to do, right? The world is saying to lean into all the things that would make us feel comfortable or happy or that we like to do because of who we are. So those are some of the things I think. And I think the other question that people will have finally is, what do we do with someone's body of work? So Pastor Lawson was involved in different seminaries. He taught at some, he taught at conferences. He wrote many books. He has all these sermons. And of course, now because of the internet, everything lives on. So you could go onto YouTube even now and find all his different sermons over the years. Do we no longer listen or read those things, especially for those people who have been shaped by his teaching?
I mean, I think it's such a difficult question because in some sense, I'd almost say, like, you might want to go on a case-by-case basis. I mean, it depends on how somebody fell. It depends on, you know, what they did after they fell. In some sense, I think it kind of depends a little bit, perhaps, on what Pastor Lawson does now. I think if he were to go in obscurity and, you know, to a dark corner and confess his sins and receive pastoral counsel from people that have helped him in the past, and he tries to repair things with his family, I think it would probably be really moving in a few years to go and look at his work and see, in fact, that he did know Christ and that Christ, you know, brought glory and forgiveness out of humiliation and shame. I mean, for heaven's sake, David sinned with Bathsheba, and then he wrote Psalms, more than one. But the most famous that my church says in Holy Week is that God will make me clean. We say that as we're contemplating the cross. So, of course, you don't just throw away everything that somebody did because they sinned. But at the same time, I think it's also probably pretty painful to maybe go back and try to learn from some of Pastor Lawson's work right now. So, I mean, I think if people had the sort of instinct that they were not going to be consuming his content, for example, or they just were not going to be reading his books, that makes a lot of sense because they've, you know, he's betrayed those who had trusted him. But I do think it's kind of a complicated thing. I don't think we can just write off people's work because they sinned, or we would have nothing to read and nothing to listen to and no theology even. But at the same time, I do think in some cases, if somebody said it better than some famous pastor, it might also be okay for his body of work to kind of melt into obscurity over time. You know, maybe a better voice who says the same things that need to be said, but who can say it in a more with the faithfulness of life, that might be okay. I don't know if people are still reading, for example, Ravi Zacharias's books. I think there are a lot of great apologists out there right now, and that, you know, it might be okay for his stuff to lie, you know, on the bookshelf untouched for a while, and then people could revisit it in the future and see if he had insight that the church really needs in spite of his betrayal and sin. So, I mean, I guess I'm a little bit ambivalent, but I believe in mercy and forgiveness, but I also think, you know, the instinct to back away for a bit is also not unwise, depending on what it is.
Well, that is a lot of food for thought. And so finally, on a very much lighter note than this topic, it is fall. So maybe this is a question more of when your kids were smaller. So what would get your family more in the seasonal spirit for fall? Apple picking or visiting the pumpkin patch?
Well, we did both a lot, and I did love apple picking, but except my children would whine so much. But there's really nothing better than propping up a little kid against a pumpkin and taking a lot of pictures. That's really, really fun. And we would always carve a pumpkin for Halloween, but my husband would tell the kids that it was Martin Luther scooping out all the corruption and rot out of the church.
Oh, that's funny. Well, thanks, Anne, for being a guest again on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to episode 413 of the Postmodern Realities podcast. Today's guest was Anne Kennedy. She has written an article in her Theological Trends column for the Christian Research Journal. Her article is called A Christian's Response to Pastor Lawson's Moral Failure, and you can read it for free without a paywall at our website, equip.org. You won't want to miss out on subscribing to the other podcasts from the Christian Research Institute. We have the Bible Answer Man podcast, which is published Monday through Friday with the best of the week on Saturday. It's hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and is available wherever you get your favorite podcasts. In addition, Hank has a podcast called Hank Unplugged. Hank takes you out of the studio and into his study to engage in free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. And you won't want to miss out on the brand new podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Christian Research Journal Reads presents audio versions of Christian Research Journal articles. It was a print incarnation of almost 45 years. It's now on the web, as you know, with new articles every single week. So you won't want to miss these audio articles of some of our most popular and most accessed articles on our website, equip.org.